really nice program that you need for your computer. It works better.
Okay, today is November the 7th, 2008. My name is Adrian Romero. I'm a student at Texas Tech University. And today I will be talking a little bit with Vietnam vet Dale Brooks. Dale, if you would, just please just tell me a little bit about yourself, your name, rank, the division you were in.
My name is Dale Brooks. I was with the Army, U.S. Army 1st Air Cav, Alpha 1-3, 1st Battalion, 3rd Brigade. I was a medic. My MOS was 91 Alpha, medical specialist. I started my military career at Fort Dix, New Jersey. I went to Fort Sam Houston for my medical training. Went to Fort Hood for a couple of weeks and then got sent overseas. And I also grew up as an Air Force brat.
Air Force brat.
Yeah, my father was in the U.S. Air Force. Actually, he was drafted in the U.S. Army, didn't like the thought of having to climb through the mud, walked across the field, and they took him in as the Army Air Corps, and for 6 months, the Army Air Corps never knew that he was there, and the Army never knew where he was. So he ended up starting off with Army Green and coming out with Air Force Blue.
That's pretty interesting. Was he alive or did he serve his whole life in the military?
No. He served just a 3-year tour.
Okay.
He was in Korea.
In Korea. Yeah. How old were you when he was in Korea?
I was born after he came back from Korea.
Oh, after he came back?
Yeah.
Does he talk to you about the war at all?
Oh, my father's dead.
Oh, he's dead.
Okay. He died in 1981.
Did he ever talk to you about his experience there?
My parents got divorced when I was 7.
When you were 7? Speaking of that, when were you born and where?
August 18th, 1953, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Literally 1 mile outside of Harvard Yard.
Okay. What was life like there growing up?
It was unusual, really. I grew up in a major city. Didn't have a lot of money. But no one really had a lot of money at that time.
Yeah. Brothers and sisters?
I got 2 brothers.
Are they older? Or?
They're younger than me.
They're younger than you, so you're the oldest one.
Yeah, and sometimes I wonder about that one, too. Yeah.
Wonder about what?
My middle brother, Dean, seems to be an independent thinker. My brother Dana and myself are the only ones that actually had a family. My brother Dean doesn't care.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why he has money and we don't.
Where'd you go to school?
Waltham High. Waltham School System. And that's W-A-L-T-H-A-M, not Waltham. Waltham.
Waltham. Yep. What kind of plans did you have when you were in school for the future?
I really didn't have any plans. It was, 60s, didn't care, really. And like a lot of the kids nowadays, they don't have plans for the future,
Right. Yeah. You didn't want to be a doctor or lawyer, you didn't think
about
that?
No, I didn't want to, I did not want to be number one in my class, because my thinking at the time was, if you were number one in the class, how can you improve? You reach the top, you only can go downhill.
Okay.
I did like certain classes. I like the sciences. I enjoy science.
What kind of things did you do for fun around your hometown?
We live so close to Boston. I mean, Waltham is only 8 miles from Boston.
And there's lots to do in Boston.
Lots of museums, every place.
Did you ever get into any trouble, like as kids do growing up?
Yep. Got in a lot of trouble.
Can you tell me a story of a time?
I wanted to go in an amusement park in Boston, just in the North Shore of Boston. And I had the money to get there, and I had money to ride some of the rides. But I didn't have money to get home. So I saw movies where they just jumped over the turnstile at the subway. Well, I caught my foot, fell, and when I fell, I screamed, and the guy realized I didn't pay for the ride.
Oh, no.
Yep. And so he started chasing me after me. My nose is bleeding, and he chased me after me. And he always followed me because I didn't realize at the time I was leaving a little trail behind me.
So you were easy to track down.
Yeah. But, no, I got home that okay. Dale, at the time I was 17, drinking age was 21. And I'm like, okay, I got a bunch of years before I could drink legally.
Right.
And about 6 weeks before my birthday, drinking age went down to 18. Yeah, so I thought there was a God up there who really liked me for a change.
That sounds like a good deal.
And so I would, you had to get a picture ID from the city. Well, the picture ID they decided to give you could not fit in your wallet because it was on a 3x5 card.
Like an index card.
No, sorry, 5x8. It was a big card, a really big card. And you had to pay for a picture, so yep, they know. And so I got it on my 18th birthday, and between City Hall and where I lived was a dozen blocks. There's also a dozen bars. And at the time, a draft was a quarter. So I checked every bar to make sure my ID was going to work. And then I got home, and I tried to sleep. And I got about 2 hours sleep, and my mother woke me up to take me out for some drinks. So I had already drank a case of a beer, basically, beforehand. And my mother's theory was, I'm going to get him as drunk as I can. He'll wake up, and he won't do it again. Well, I had mixed drinks on top of beer. I had a lot of them. And the bar that she took me to was about a block away from the house. It took me about 2 hours to crawl. As my mother said, you got on your hands and knees and then fell on your face. Got on your hands and knees and fell on your face. Yep. And it took me a while to climb up four stairs.
Four stairs.
Four stairs to get into the apartment.
Okay.
You know, I went brain dead.
So you were a little inebriated.
I couldn't remember how to pick my foot up high enough to...
Yeah.
And then I climbed into bed. And I had to sleep with my foot on the floor to keep the bed from moving.
Right, because the room was spinning.
Yep. And next morning, she decided to vacuum my room. So anything she couldn't do to make noise, she did. Volume control on the TV was sensitive, you know, right. Hit it wrong, it's static, you know. Mm-hmm. Didn't work.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, when was the first time that you heard about what was going on in Vietnam?
I was in elementary school, and we had a map of Vietnam on the wall. Mm-hmm. And we would have push pins, and we would keep... Our goal, our assignment every day was to watch the news, find out where the battles were, the casualties, both sides, what units were involved, when they would say what units were involved, and come back the next day for school, and we would all compare notes to see which one missed what, you know, and put a pin on the wall. You know, so we knew what was going on.
Okay.
And when I was in the third grade, we had a unit in Vietnam everybody wrote a letter to. We didn't have any soldiers' names. We just had a unit to send letters to.
Okay.
We sent them to an air cavalry unit.
Did they ever send them back to you?
We got letters back, too, yeah.
What do you think about those letters?
Being in the Air Force and understanding what goes on in the military, it was still scary. We would get letters from their parents, too, the soldiers' parents, appreciating the fact that someone cared enough for someone they never knew to write to.
Right.
And we did get some letters back saying the soldier died. And at that age, you know, because I was in the, grew up in the service, I knew, you know. And some of the others just, at that age, you're not quite sure what death really is.
Did you enlist voluntarily, or?
No.
So you were drafted.
I was drafted.
Tell me what happened the day that you got your the draft notice.
I called home saying I was going to go out drinking. Yep. And my mother was not a happy person at the time. She's also dead right now. She said, no, you have an important letter waiting for you. I'm talking about what important letter? Yep. She wouldn't tell me what important. You just got an important letter waiting for you. So, okay, I decided to stop at the house, you know, before going out to drink. And I showed up the letter, you know, and it didn't say greetings or welcome. It said report. You know, the greetings and welcomes, happy horse stuff was over by that time.
Right.
You know. I knew it was going to happen eventually. You know,
a lot of friends, acquaintances that you knew, were they getting?
They were. All, we were all seeming to get this. Yeah.
Okay. How long after you got that letter did
I had 10 days to report.
10 days.
10 days. And the thing is Boston is a center for the physicals and everything else. And there was a part of me like, please, let me fail my physical.
I see.
You know, and one of the few times I actually got an A. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And they wanted to know what I was interested in. I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah.
I knew I wasn't interested in being there, really, and be there, but I wasn't going to say no either, because my generation, there were some that in my generation that took off, you know, went north across the border. But see, a lot of Americans don't realize a lot of Canadians came to the United States to enlist in the U.S. military.
To help the cause.
Yeah, and a lot of people from other countries came to the United States too. I dated a girl afterwards. Her brother, she was from Germany. Her brother came to the United States, was here long enough to for a green card, and then enlisted in the Marines. Never came home, but yeah. And I understand, I mean, you know, people who don't want to, you know, they have, that's their right. I don't always agree with them, but, you know, they're not always going to agree with me either.
How'd you feel entering the military at such a hot time, if you will?
I grew up...
Did it cross your mind that you were going...
Yeah, I it did, but, you know, I entered in the service in a time where we had what this, a lot of this generation doesn't have is duty and honor. These things were expected, you know. Like when I'm at work, I have a job that is assigned to me, but that does not limit what I do at work. If someone comes over and says, this needs to be done, my generation, you know, that's part of my job. You know, if a supervisor comes over and says we need you to do something, it's no question. You don't question that. You just do it. That's part of my generation. You know, and this generation is like, why? It's not my job. No.
Okay.
I mean, when you start a company, unless they print it out on a piece of paper and tell you exactly what you do, and you can't overstep those boundaries, there's no boundaries. Yeah. Unless it's on paper, there's no boundaries. Yeah.
So, what year was it when you entered the training and the boot camp? And
I went in August of 72.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how far between, when did you actually set foot on Vietnam?
I set in February of 73.
February 73. What did you think getting off Did you come by boat or was it
a aircraft? I went by aircraft, U.S. Air Force transport.
Stepping off the plane, what did you think?
All practical purposes, this is too real to do. The movie Green Beret was, compared to what I saw, was a joke.
Really? They didn't get it right?
They got a lot of it right, but the thing is they couldn't really get it right because it was made during Vietnam. You know, the general public did not want to see, you know, they heard from civilian reporters. And civilian reporters will have a tendency to express their points of view.
Right.
But then again, every reporter will try to and civilian reporters didn't want to be there. So they didn't think we should be there. So there was not a whole lot of why we should be there, is that we shouldn't be there. You know, and you got to realize that Green Beret was made in 1968. That was not too long after the Tet Offensive. You know, and they were showing the dedication of just one unit, or the special forces. As the movie goes, it's an interesting movie because they show things that the general public has no idea about.
Like what?
They showed the fact that the base camps did use tricks that Charlie showed us. We would put punji sticks around the camps. But we didn't use the same stuff they were using. They would dip the punji sticks in shit and let it dry. So
that when you stepped on it, you'd get a nasty infection.
A nasty infection, yeah. Yeah. We also used a lot of claymores, which are anti-personnel mines. Yeah. A lot of base camps had 50 calibers. You know, they're basically something that will reach out and touch you.
Right.
Yeah.
Reach out and touch someone.
Yeah, mortars. I know how to fire a mortar.
Yeah. You do?
Yeah. I got trained with a lot of different weapons, you know, because real simple, something happens, you got to know what. You know, if a mortar crew goes down, you got to know what happened. You have to do it. Yeah. I talked to some of the kids and they're like, well, I don't feel good, so I'm going to call in sick. I can't. There are situations you cannot call in sick. And one kid said, what? Where can you work that you can't call in sick? And I said, in the jungles of Vietnam, you just can't wake up in the morning and say, hey, I don't feel good today. Please don't shoot at me.
Right.
Doesn't work that way. You know, and the thing is that these kids have no idea where Vietnam is located on the map.
That's true.
They're not even too sure about the war that's going on now. They're not really sure about where that place is either.
How did your family react to you leaving here? How did they handle your mother?
My mother did the worst thing possible. I mean, this is the worst thing you could ever do to a son or a daughter going into service. She wrote a letter to the commanding general at Fort Dix, basically saying, please do not yell at my son.
Okay.
That letter got to New Jersey before I did. That letter worked its way through the chain of command and got to where my basic training unit was before me.
Yes.
Sergeant called the whole company up and read the letter. And I was saying, thank God he didn't, he mentioned my name.
He did mention your name.
He mentioned my name. And I had a chance to call home, and my mother, being the brain dead person she was, asked me if they're yelling at me. Lying as well as I could at the time. No. And she said, if they're yelling, I could write you another letter.
Did you get a little harassment from the guys?
Little, no. Lots, yes. Yes. Yes, I was used as an example because I had the reputation-based training of being a mama's boy.
Oh, really?
Yep. And then they were going down the line and says, we're looking for volunteers to go to Sam Houston for medical training. Stood in front of me and thanked me. Didn't open my mouth, just stood in front of me and thanked me. So I'm, okay. That letter got for Sam Houston before I did.
Yep. So they forwarded it along.
They forwarded it along. Yep. It went through the chain of command and found me again. Yep. That letter made it to Vietnam before me.
No.
Yep. So there I had to prove.
Right.
Yep. I had to prove myself.
Can you tell me a little bit about your training? And how it went? You were on the medevac.
Yep.
A team. What kind of training is involved with that?
You have to. The training you get in the Army, in the medical training, is general training, and it gets you prepared for what you're going to see and experience to a degree. But until you see it in real life, it's a picture on the screen. And when you're actually seeing real wounded people, a lot of the things you learn go out the window. You know, safety pins is a good thing to stop wounds.
Safety pins?
Safety pins.
How so?
Closed wounds.
Stick them together.
Stick them together. You know, duct tape is another one.
So you had to improvise a lot.
Improvise, yep.
Is it because you didn't have the tools, or just...
Didn't have the time.
The time.
You know, what they teach you in school, they give you a time limit, but you got time. And in reality, you don't go for one person. If the helicopter is going out, he's not just picking one person up.
When was the first time you witnessed violence and wounded? Can you remember?
About 12 hours after I got there.
That fast?
That fast.
You were already in the action that quickly.
Yeah, there is no warm-up period. Slowly, it's one of those things, when you're driving a car, the car is moving or it's not. There's no in-between. You know, you turn that key on, it's running or it's not. There's no in-between. You know, that gray line doesn't exist.
Do you remember what the mission was, or what your...
We picked some Marines up. You know, and...
And you were on the choppers?
I was on the chopper, and it was scary. It was...
So you would go into these hot landing zones.
Very hot.
Land chopper.
Yeah, the only time you landed a chopper, the only time the gear hit the ground is when you were pulled wounded in there. Otherwise, you did not touch the ground. You stayed...
Coffee, sir?
Yes, please. And some more creamer, please. If you're going to evac from them, you are always about a foot to 2 feet off the ground. And for the simple reason, if you land, the motor slows down. It takes a little while for the motor to crank up again. You don't have that time. The longer you're given 3 seconds to evac. The chopper lowers down, 3 seconds. You're not off in 3 seconds. You're going for another ride. And I'm telling you, when you get back to the base, people there, I'm not going to be real happy that you're back there. Yeah. And especially without a hole in your system.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, if you guys start trying to get out, okay, they'll understand that one. But if you're back and there's no hole in you, they'll send you back again. Yeah. And they're not going to be happy, because that means there's another chance you're going to lose a chopper. And that time, most of the choppers never came back.
On average, how many wounded soldiers could you put in there?
Wounded soldiers, depending on the severity of the wound, if it was a walking wounded, term used, someone's hit in the arm, a leg wound, or you could sit up, you could put 6 to 8. But if they're stretchers, 2 or 3. Because you got to have room to move around, because you take care of them.
So I guess you saw some pretty bad. It was mainly the wounded, or did you carry any of the deceased killed in actions?
And when the zones became safer, they were never safe. You will never. There's no such thing in a war of a green zone. They tell you it's a green zone, so you are more relaxed. The reality is there's no green zone in a war. If you're there, you're a target, no matter where you are. If someone wants to get to you, they're going to get to you. You know? It's real simple. They're going to. You know? No matter how hard you try, they'll get to you.
Is there any particular pickups that you remember specifically, or any conversations you had with any of the wounded guys?
No. I remember becoming really isolated. I would isolate so much. Yeah.
You isolated yourself.
Yeah.
And it was because of seeing those guys.
Knowing that there was some that you couldn't do anything. And really wanting to just shoot them because they weren't going to make it and they were in too much pain. Just wanting to
put them out of their misery.
Put them out of their misery. And knowing you couldn't do it. And just going back on some flights that were 45 minutes, knowing once they got to a mass unit, they're just going to put them on the side and let them die.
Really? They can't do anything to try to make them more comfortable in the process? Or
sometimes you can't. Sometimes you can't.
About how many pickups do you think that you did while you were there, estimated?
Can.
Lots.
One day we did 9 missions, same hot zone. Yeah, numbers. It gets to the point where a number doesn't mean anything anymore. It doesn't. Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, some people don't understand. You know, they're looking forward to the weekend. For me, Saturday or Wednesday, it doesn't matter. They spell the day different. It doesn't matter. It's just, it's a day. It's no big thing. You know, you get to a point where a number just isn't a big thing anymore. You cannot, the mind just doesn't want to deal with it anymore. You know, how many is too many? You know, there's a wall of 58,000 people on it. Those are the ones that died in country or in the territorial waters. How many people died on the way back?
Yeah. Right.
Number's too many. It's too big. Yeah. You get to that point where it doesn't care. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
What do you think kept you motivated to get through those hard times? What helped you push through?
I had no one at home. I didn't have a girlfriend, didn't have a family, didn't have anybody at home to get to the point where they're going to. The only person I had home was my mother. Anything happened, she would have got the flag. But there was nobody else. I didn't have to worry about leaving anyone behind. I honestly didn't think I was going to come home. I really did not think I was going to come home.
Was that before you left or while you were there?
While I was there.
Did it change? Did your idea about that change before you went and then when you got there?
I was hoping to come home before I got there. When I saw what was going on and what I heard was happening back here, didn't want to come home. Wasn't going to do anything, but I didn't think I was going to come home.
Because the Americans had turned, at this point they had turned against the war.
Yeah, I didn't think I would, really, I did not think I was going to come home. Yeah, so I did, took a little more chances. Tried to save a few more people. Because, you know, hey, you're not going to make it home. Who cares? Because yeah. I didn't have anybody to come home to, you know, so I didn't care.
Did you establish any friendships there at, yeah. amongst the other soldiers, team members?
Yeah. Recently, a friend of mine ate a bullet, couldn't deal with it anymore.
The guy that you were with?
Yeah. He just couldn't deal with it anymore. Yeah, generally speaking, I think about it almost every day. Yeah. I'm not going to do it, I just...
Right.
It crosses my mind. Yeah. And the thing is, people I work with just... They can't understand it. Either because they're too young... Or they have never experienced anything similar to it. Yeah. Some of the people I work with, they break up from their boyfriend. That's the worst thing in the world for them.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that is a tragedy. If they knew what I went through, that's nothing.
What did you guys do for entertainment there?
Drinking was a big thing.
The Budweiser?
No, we weren't lucky. Where I was to get Budweiser, we got some Vietnamese beer. It's called 33. And they used to put a little formaldehyde in the beer for an aging process.
Formaldehyde?
In the beer.
Oh, no.
Yeah. One of the jokes about Vietnam is it goes, I heard there was a drug problem in Vietnam. Answer, no, we all have drugs. No problem. You get to the point where you just you give up, but you can't give up because your training won't let you give up. But you just want to give up. You know, you just get tired.
Was there anyone or anything that you missed back home while you were away at war? Was there anything that you missed?
In the beginning, I missed the ocean. I missed watching the sunrise over the ocean because I'm from Massachusetts, East Coast.
Right.
So I was able to see that on occasion. I missed being able to walk through the park and listen to the birds sing. And in Boston, we got this. It's called the Swan Boat Ride. It's a little pond in the middle of Boston. And there's these boats, these paddle boats, and the guy sits in a booth, and it looks like a big swan. And you just go around, and you buy a little bag of popcorn, and the ducks jump on the boat, and you feed the popcorn to the ducks. And if you don't feed the popcorn to the ducks, the duck will bite you in the ankle, like, hey, it's my popcorn, feed me. You know, I miss those things. I miss watching squirrels chasing each other. I miss quiet. You learn certain sounds, and those sounds never leave. Never leave. I'm afraid of fireworks. Yeah. Not because they're fireworks, because when they leave the tube to go up in the air, it sounds like a mortar shell leaving the tube. Yeah. That's the noise that gets me. You've heard it once, and can't describe it. It's like a thud. And you know something has just been launched. Now you're trying to figure out, where is it going? Well, it's fireworks going up in the sky, but that noise is telling me something else. You know?
Right.
And there's certain smells. Certain smells.
That take you back to the war.
Yeah. You know, if you ever smell a pig farm, all you have to do is just mention the pig farm. That smell comes back to you.
Yes.
It is a very unique smell, like no other type of farm.
Mm-hmm.
And right away, you're there.
Yeah. Right.
And it's a disgusting smell. It really is. It just, you know, and it, that's the way it is. I had a nervous breakdown in the 90s. And what led to it was something that scared me real bad. I had bought an AR-15. which is a civilian version of an M16.
Okay.
It was a semi-automatic. That's as far as it would go. I wasn't having a good period of time when I was married, not because of the marriage, because of memories. This is my ex-wife now, but she walked in on me and scared me. I turned, pointed the weapon at her, and pulled the trigger. It misfired. She left right away. I understand. I really do. I don't hate her for it. I understand. And, you know, I still care for her, even though we're not married. You know.
But that ended the marriage.
And shortly after that, I was in the psychiatric unit for over a year. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. To this day, I really would like to get into a relationship, but I'm afraid. There is a big fear there. And it's on all levels. I mean, I work with some very attractive people. And there are a few people there that I would do anything to help them, anything. In fact, very few people know that before I got hired the job I'm at now, I went in and there was one person who waited on me. And I was just like, oh my God, is she gorgeous? I went back and applied for a job at that store to be working with her. Even though she doesn't know how I feel about her, I had, you know, so whenever I see her, it brings me back to that first day. And she is really, you know, really attractive. But my fear is I can't tell her because of that, you know. Yeah, I want to be close to her, but I'm afraid to be close to her. I would like to have a hug, but I'm afraid to have a hug. I am still, you know.
Have you sought any outside help?
Yeah, I'm in counseling now. I'm in therapy now.
How's that going for you?
It's slow.
Some water?
Yes, please.
Don't forget to put some lemon in it, please. It's slow because you gotta realize that I'm dealing with civilians who weren't even alive during that period of time. So alive it is having to explain. You know, history books were written by winners,
right?
You know, to try and make themselves look better. And if it didn't fit their curriculum, it was a lie. Yeah. Benjamin Franklin came up with a nice phrase. He said, treason was a charge invented by the winners to hang the losers. Yeah. And that, to a degree, is what's taught. Yeah. It's my way of thinking. Whoever's writing the book, that's their way of thinking. You know, doesn't mean it's true. You know, and if people knew exactly what happened there, beginning of Vietnam, when American troops were there, there had been advisors in Vietnam for many years before combat troops were actually sent there. There was a place that the Americans called Valley of Death. French were there. We were there 11 years after they were. Yeah. We also had respect for our enemy, too, to a degree. You know, you talk to people who are fighting now, they're called Chowheads.
Right.
We call him Charlie.
Right.
Charlie knew what he was doing. Yeah. You cannot take that away.
Do you think that we underestimated him going in?
Very much so. For the simple fact that that is their backyard, they could probably tell you the bark on every tree in their neighborhood. Johnson said it would be impossible to take someone from a major city and send him into a jungle. What would people in New York know about a jungle? Yeah. What would people in New York know about woods to speak of? Yeah. It would be hard.
And there was no training out there to prepare you for... To even prepare you for that.
You can never be trained for it. there is always going to be something that's totally unexpected. Before every mission, there are three parts to a mission. The briefing, what to expect. The mission itself, what you did. And the debriefing, what you actually saw there. And the briefing and the debriefing were never going to be close. Never. We expect this. We saw this. Opposite sides. You expected this, meaning we saw a whole division. You expect a couple of companies. We saw a whole division. Come on. The numbers ain't adding up.
What was your opinion about your leaders?
I had some that I would have liked to shot myself. We call them butterballs. Also known as 90 Day Wonders. Yeah. 90 Day Wonders. After 90 days of officer training school, they're an officer. Second lieutenant. They're put in charge. They have no idea what's going on, but they're put in charge, and you got to follow what they say. And if you don't, you're in trouble. But if you do, you're just as much trouble, too. There are times where you look at them, and you're like, well, no, I wouldn't go down there. I know what I'm doing. No. If it looks too safe, it's not necessarily safe.
What do you think about the intelligence of some of the missions? Was it on or was it inaccurate most of the time?
Most of them were inaccurate.
Why do you think that is?
For example, if you're hunting a deer, the deer knows you're coming. But the deer doesn't know where you're coming from. Doesn't know how many are there, but he can smell someone's there. Same way in the jungle. We knew they were there. We didn't know where they were, how many there were, but we knew they were there. We didn't have the advantage of smelling which direction they were coming from. We knew they were there. They knew we were there. So to a degree, we were both in the blind, but they also had the advantages of tunnels.
The tunnels. Did you get to see any of the tunnels yourself?
No. A friend of mine did a whole tour as a tunnel rat. And I asked him, how did you get in the tunnel? He was describing, and I said, no, that isn't what I mean. You can't have to have balls this big to climb into a tunnel with a flashlight and a 45. No helmet, no flak jacket. And a lot of the tunnel rats got killed on the way out.
On the way out?
On the way out. Because the booby traps would fold down with the weight and spring back up after you got off of them.
Oh, I see.
So you back into them.
But your friend survived all that.
13 months as a tunnel rat. Wow. And tunnel rats, life expectancy was measured in days to hours.
Really?
Really, yeah.
What do you think the worst experience was while you were there? Your worst experience?
I had a few. I had a few real bad ones one time.
I think one time I talked to you before, you told me that your birthday had was a significant. Every year your birthday falls on a significant, or it reminds you of a significant event.
Yeah. And we were on the ground. And guy was running out of the jungle, and I took the Marine's weapon and I killed him. I saw his face. How can you not be affected by knowing you took someone's life? I didn't know if he had a family. Had any of his own children. His parents were going to miss him. At the time, it didn't bother me. It took a while later, I realized.
After you returned home?
I'm not a violent person. You've known me for a while. I'm not violent. I don't yell. I don't scream. I don't raise my voice. I don't threaten anybody. I don't use a threatening posture.
But you saw this man come as a threat to you and your brothers.
Yep.
and you made the decision, and now you've had to live with that decision. And it happened on your birthday.
It happened on my birthday.
So while other people are blowing out candles and pulling
out the party
hats, I'm
blowing out the lights. I'm taking a life. You know, and you, since I work directly with you, you know, by looking at me, you couldn't tell.
No. There's no way I could have known that.
No. By looking at me, you've seen a history with me. You have a history with me. You see the things that I do. You've seen the way I act. You see, you know, there's that period of time. If you saw me then, you would never know it was the same person.
If, I know you think, you told me that you think about him all the time. If there was anything that you could say to his family or people that he left behind.
I couldn't come up with the words. Really couldn't. How can you explain it? How? You can't. How can you say you're sorry? The word sorry does not cover anything. You know, there are instances that you can't say anything because there's no way of putting it. There's no words you can actually use to express it. You can't. So you don't try.
What do you think about, what if you hadn't shot him? What if you hadn't seen him?
At the time, I didn't care. At that time.
It was instinct.
It was instinct, yep.
That's what you've been trained for, and then the training kicked in.
Yep.
And
do you know how you can tell of someone who's been in the service? There's a couple of ways.
Okay.
How does he carry anything in his hands?
Okay.
90% of the people who have ever been in the service will always carry something in their left hand. Very rarely would they carry anything in their right hand. For the simple purpose, you salute with the right hand.
Okay.
You're always carrying your gear with your left hand. You're carrying your weapon in your right hand because that's used to pull the trigger, your right hand.
Right.
But if you're carrying, and even now, I leave the store with my stuff, it's in my left hand. I carry anything, it's in my left hand. I carry my laundry to the laundromat, it's in my left hand. Very rarely do I put anything in my right hand. That's it.
This got conditioned too.
Yeah. I don't feel comfortable carrying anything in my right hand. Now, it's capable of doing just the same thing, but I carry everything in my left. When I carry a couple of bags of groceries out for people, it's in my left hand. Yeah. Very rarely will I carry anything in both hands. If I could carry it in one hand, it's in my left hand. Always.
What's the other way you can tell someone's in the military?
A lot of ways is the way they walk. You know, the whole demeanor about the person. You've seen the veterans that come into the store.
Yes.
You see how they walk. Yep, they're tall.
They have a little swagger to their walk. I have noticed that.
Yep.
The ones that I've met.
Yep.
You
also see me going to them. Yep. If it's not busy, I will walk over to every veteran that comes in that door. Yep. Introduce myself. Anything I could do, next time you come in, I will come over and see how you're doing.
There's that strong sense of brotherhood.
Yeah. Because when you're in, commonly known as the shit, they're the only ones there. Yep. You're covering them, they're covering you. They know what you're going through because you're going what they're going through. Yep. Also, you could tell to a degree, a lot of veterans have, every veteran I've ever met from Vietnam has is what's called the 1,000-yard stare.
Tell me what that is.
They see right through you. They really, when I was in the hospital before I moved to Pennsylvania, I spent 10 days in a psychiatric unit with my friend, who was a Vietnam veteran too. Yeah. I wore my shirt to the hospital, Map of Vietnam, introducing me as a Vietnam veteran, my POW hat. And he was wearing a Marine Corps hat. Well, Army, Marine Corps, don't care, you know. Went over and introduced myself. He saw the shirt and wanted to take it off my back. So I had the shirt made for him, you know. But we were sitting there eating and with a couple other people. And both of us, we just got in that stare. We just like saw right through people. They know they were there. Just, you know. And it was like someone had to snap us out of it. You know, hey, you know. Oh, right, right.
Right.
Yeah, you just, also in 91 when I was in the hospital, a helicopter flew overhead, scared me. I jumped into a ditch. And, well, the ditch happened to be filled with water, and some of the people I was with thought it was funny. Didn't think it was funny. It scared me.
Thought you were just goofing around or something?
Yeah,
or?
Scared me. You know, you gotta hide someplace. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that you had were you in MIA or?
No.
Okay.
MIA is missing in action.
Right, okay.
And no, I wasn't a POW either.
And you had
I have a hat that says MIA POW.
Oh, I see. I guess one time when I talked to you before, you told me that you had a Purple Heart.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how you received that?
I got shot. I got a big scar on my stomach.
I got shot in the stomach.
I got 2 feet less intestines than most people do. Actually, I still have it's right in here where it was taken out. So right above it is where the regular intestine was. Underneath is where it was missing, so it still bulges out.
What can you tell me about that day?
Just getting ready to come home.
You were getting ready to come home?
Yep. Less than 24 hours before I was getting ready to come home. Yeah.
And you were doing a pickup, or?
No. I was in what was called a green zone. Yeah. And a sniper got too close.
A sniper?
Yeah. They're every place. The thing is that when we're over in this particular war, we can tell to a degree who the enemy is. You know, because they look different. Yeah. In Vietnam, who could you tell? You know, is he a member of the South Vietnamese Army or of the VC? They look the same. Yeah. Yeah, you couldn't tell. Yeah. Those problems started in Korea, too. Because some of the South Koreans were willing to shoot you, too. Just as well as the North Koreans.
What were you doing right before you got shot?
I was getting ready to, I had just packed all my gear. I was going to chow, actually. I was going to go eat. And I had this, it felt like a horse had kicked me. It just took me off my feet. And then it started to hurt. And the pain was like, I can't describe the pain. Yet. It hurt so much, I couldn't cry. Couldn't. Yeah. And I was just bleeding.
You know what type of round it was that got you, or what kind of, did it go straight through?
No. So I was near the end of the range, but couldn't give me anything for pain because I'm allergic to those painkillers. Yeah, so
I just had to tough it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a hero. I'm not a tough guy. I'm not. You know, some people I work with think I am. I'm not. Yeah. I was asked to do a job. I did the job. I'm not a hero. I don't want to be a hero. I don't want someone to look at me and say, hey man, that's a hero. No, I'm not. You know, I'm just a person who did a job. You know, and it took, when I came back and touched U.S. soil, it took a lot of years before I actually came home, even though I was on U.S. soil.
That was my next question. How do you think what changed when you got back to the U.S.?
General public didn't want us to come back. Yeah, I wasn't looking for a parade. I wasn't looking for a pat on the back. I just wanted to come home. I just wanted to have a life again. Because of the scar on my stomach, I'm reminded all the time. Yeah, I did not want. Yeah. Most people I work with never know I have a scar on my stomach. They don't know. One, they don't need to know. Two, I'm not going to tell them. I don't want them to know. Yeah. There are a couple of people there close to my age. They understand. But when I came back from Vietnam, I just wanted to come home. I wanted to resume a life. People wouldn't let me come home. You know, you get off the plane and you could tell a veteran right away, haircut. Yeah. Especially since it was in the 70s, long hair was still a big thing. Haircut, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and when I got to San Diego, lady walked over to me and said, "We don't want you here anymore." On March of this year, one of the kids I work with was in a break room. She said, "We don't want you here." Talk about big trigger. One of the few times I actually wanted to hit someone. And this person didn't know better. Doesn't know. Yeah. He had no idea. 16 years old, has no idea. Yeah. Yeah. I've had people ask me stupid questions about it, about my service. I've had people ask me real intelligent questions too. Yeah. I look at it either way, they're curious. The stupid question is because they're not taught. The intelligent question is because they really are concerned. You know? Generally speaking, I don't talk to anybody about it.
You mentioned to me the other day that you don't talk to it about with your family, with your kids.
No.
Is there a reason? Is there a reason why you don't talk to your kids about it, or?
You can't. My son was born December 7th, 1981. Doesn't need to know. Doesn't need to know that daddy's a killer. All my son needs to know is that daddy loves him.
So you want to shield him from the fact that you took a man's life?
Yeah. Doesn't need to know it. You know, many veterans, even from Korea, won't talk about this. Gentleman we talked to for a few minutes that one day, Korean veteran. Yeah. He doesn't have to tell me. I don't have to tell him. We know. Yeah. But he's very eager to see me.
Right.
Yeah. He always comes over to me. I always go over to him. Yeah. We have a bond that most people will never understand and never accept. And that bond goes to the point where Vietnam veterans will hug each other. And general public will look at him and go, "Are they gay?"
Right.
Vietnam veteran, one of the first things a Vietnam veteran will say to another Vietnam veteran, always, "Welcome home."
Yeah. Because
we weren't.
You weren't welcome home.
Yeah. And that poem I gave you.
Yes.
Very deep. Very few words.
That was one of the things, though. One of my questions today was going to, we're going to talk about your writings. Mm-hmm. You've written some poems.
Yep.
You've written you've just written stories and
I'm in the middle of writing.
You're in the middle of writing a book.
Of writing a book called My Sins Will Return Again.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you're going to put in there?
That is just covering a two-year period of my life, mm-hmm. from when I went to New Jersey until I came home and got discharged. That's all it's covering. It's those 2 years. The first subtitle of it is The Conflict of Man. Yeah. I'm still writing drafts and notes and taking, and it's going to take me a while because you sit there and you start thinking and second emotionally. My mother died September 9th, 1988, and between September 9th, 1988 and now present, which is November 8th, 2008, I've cried three times. And one time I felt I was obligated to, because my mother died. I was obligated to cry. Didn't want to, I was obligated. When my wife left, you know, my moment, my little security to sanity had gone too. Shortly after she left, I was in the hospital. You know, and when my friend killed himself three times since 88, I've wanted to cry. I dream about crying. I wonder what it would be like to actually sit and have a good cry. But as everything starts to tear up, it's like a little switch, it turns itself off. Don't feel anything. Yeah. What you hear here and what you see at work, you can never, it's not the same person. You know, what you're hearing here and what you see when I do my job, you know, it's my job. What I do is my job. I do my job to the best of my ability at that moment in time. And if there's a problem, I tell my manager. I tell the people I have to answer to what's going on. But generally speaking, seeing me sit here and seeing me there, would you say it's the same person?
No.
No?
It's like you've got to be exhausting to lead two separate lives like that.
It is. You know, I do everything I need to do and more at the store. That's my job.
And that's how your writings help you.
Yeah.
It's kind of a healing process.
Yeah. Some of those, very few people have actually seen the poems and thoughts that I've given you. Very few people. They don't need to see it. I know. You know, some of them are happier than others.
That's so, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Some of them are deeper than others. Some are very stressful. Some of them are in as someone looking in to a situation.
Yeah.
Those are me. Yeah. Just depending on how I felt at the moment I wrote them. Yeah. And some of them are very complex. Some are very simple.
You wrote a poem called The Wall.
Yeah.
Took
me over a year to write it.
Took you a year to write it. And you wrote it as the perspective of the wall.
Yeah.
Like the wall is speaking to you.
Vietnam veterans hear that wall. General public, oh, that's really sad. Vietnam veterans, we hear these souls telling us, you know.
Don't forget.
Don't forget. We don't want you on our side just yet. Don't come. Yeah. You'll be here eventually, but we don't want you now. Yeah. More Vietnam veterans have died since Vietnam in such a short period of time than World War II veterans or Korean War veterans.
Yeah.
The life expectancy of a Vietnam veteran after Vietnam is not a real long life. Yeah. During World War II, they came back in ships as a group. Vietnam veterans, one day you're in the jungle and 2 days later you're home. Where's the debriefing? You came across the Atlantic Ocean, take you days, but You know, they were prepared for you to come home.
Right.
You know, I'm upset and I'm saddened at the same time. Veterans that come back from this war, people stand up at airports and applaud. I'm angry. I'm pissed off. I am really pissed off that this government, these people are doing this to me again. You know? It's like Korea started the problem. Korean veterans were accepted back. Gulf War veterans are accepted. Veterans now are accepted. My group weren't. You know, it's a slap in our face still. Hey, thank you for serving. You mentioned Vietnam, and they don't want to hear it. You mentioned the Gulf War. Or, you know, they want to hear it. But, he did the same job I did, and there's similar situations I did. Why am I bad? You know, he joined. I had no choice. He decided to do that. And I'm bad? That doesn't make sense. No, that's a slap in my face again. I want to be home. You welcomed him home. You have never really welcomed me home. Yeah. I'm the one that drives the truck that brings food to you. He's basically out of high school. Yeah. Come on, kick me again. I'm down. I didn't feel that one. Kick me again. Yeah. You know, I'm happy and I'm angry at the same time. These people are being accepted. Okay, I can deal with that. I'm not still being accepted. I can't deal with that. Come on. I'm a human being too. Yeah.
Do you think that America's attitude after all these years is finally shifting to be more accepting of you?
I think to
a
big degree, yes. But I also think it got to a point and then it stopped. And the way I can say it stopped is look in a high school history book. Okay? What are they taught? Yeah. Ask a high school student. What does he know? Yeah. Like I was saying, when I was in school, we had a map of Vietnam. Do they have a map of Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan on the walls, keeping track of what's going on? No.
Yeah. Besides getting welcome home, do you see some similarities between you being a soldier and the soldiers that are out there right now?
Soldiers out here, yeah, I see a big similarity and a difference too at the same time. They're more in a desert situation. They can see a lot of the things happening, knowing that they're going to be in danger. Can't tell one tree to another. You know, we're both doing jobs. We both did jobs. We both did what the government asked us to do. You know. This government might not agree with the policy, but asked its citizens to take part. And I see the pride that my generation and this generation has, the ones in the service, the ones in ROTC programs, the ones looking for a career. You know, I see that. The differences I also see is that there's some that go into the services because they'll pay for college, get a bonus to join. Yeah. When I was in the service because I was obligated, my generation, we felt obligated to do many things. This generation doesn't feel obligated.
If you were able to talk to a new soldier,
they tell them
that they're going to Iraq, what kind of advice would you have for these guys? As far as what they can expect, maybe. how to deal with
you really look at the person standing next to you and do not look at certain things. Certain things have to leave your mind. You cannot look at these certain things. You can look at the color of the skin. You can't listen to his accent. You cannot determine what he calls his God. Those things mean nothing to you. Absolutely nothing. He's wearing a uniform. He's doing a job that you're doing. He depends on you to do your job. You depend on him to do his job. If he doesn't do his job, you're dead. You don't do your job, you're dead, he's dead. Plain and simple. You're going to die if you do not do your job. If you do not do it to the best of your ability, 100% of the time. You know? If it scares you and you have to clean your uniform later on, you got to do your job right then and there. It doesn't matter. You know, I mean, you wet yourself, it doesn't matter. You got to do your job.
What would you say to a soldier that may find himself in the same situation as you were when you shot the enemy? You see a guy coming towards you. Would you tell him not to hesitate?
You can't. You don't. You don't have time to think. You are trained so well, you do not have time to think. You think after the action. You cannot think before it. You think before it, you're dead. You hesitate, you're dead. You have to. They drill it into you during basic training, and depending on what field you're going into, they drill it into your head. You think, you hesitate, you're dead. Point blank. You don't have time. Yep. You practice it all the time.
Yep. Is there anyone that you still are in contact with?
A guy named Frank. In Pennsylvania.
He's in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
How often do you guys talk?
Once a week, twice a week.
Once a week. How's he coping with his...
He just got married a little while ago, though. You know?
He did?
Yeah.
Does he have kids? And
he's got kids, but he married a girl a lot younger.
Really?
Yeah. And I wanted to be there for the wedding, but I couldn't. Yeah. Not because I couldn't, because I was here in Texas, I didn't have the money to go to Pennsylvania.
Right.
But no, I've made movies for him, burned some DVDs, some music, and sent it to him.
That's good.
And when I lived in Pennsylvania, I'd invite him over to my place, spend the night, watch movies, TV, whatever.
Speaking of movies, before I took this class, the only thing that I did take... In our history classes, we had about a week that we talked about the Vietnam War. This was back in 1990. I'm in school again.
Yep.
But the only thing that I really knew about Vietnam were was what was in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Full Metal Jacket, and Platoon, Hamburger Hill.
Mm-hmm.
We Were Soldiers.
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now.
Deer Hunter.
The Deer Hunter.
Those movies. Most of those movies you mentioned are real life. They made it into a movie, so they had to change some things to make it look good for a movie. There was a TV program that lasted one season called China Beach.
China Beach. I've heard of it.
That was the my generation version of MASH. MASH was a comedy. China Beach was not. China Beach showed you to a great degree the reality of war. MASH didn't show you the reality of war. They showed you the casualties of war, not the reality of war.
So you think for the most part Hollywood has it right?
To a degree, yes. There are some. Good Morning Vietnam is a comedy look of Vietnam through Adrian Cronauer, which is a real person. He really was in Vietnam. In fact, when Adrian Cronauer left Vietnam, the person who took his place at the radio station is a host of a game show.
Oh, really?
Really. Pat Sajak.
Pat Sajak was it?
Took Adrian Cronauer's place in Vietnam.
Wow.
Yeah. He won't talk about it. Never talks about it. This is not an easy thing for me to talk about right now.
Can you sit and watch some of those movies?
No. I can watch about 5 or 6 minutes, and then I got to stop the movie. Can't watch anymore. Yeah?
It's hard to... It really drives it home again.
Yeah.
It brings it back to life.
Yep. I have a shirt. I don't wear it very often. It shows a battle scene. It says, been there, done it. When I first moved to Texas, I wore my Vietnam shirt on the bus because I didn't have a car at the time. People would get up and walk to the other side of the bus. I couldn't deal with that. I couldn't accept it. Why? You know, it just blew me away that people would avoid me because I'm wearing a shirt that said Vietnam. You ever dealt with something so stupid that you couldn't finish the sentence because you knew deep down inside if you finished the sentence it would be just as dumb as the thing you're trying to make a comment about?
Yes.
I mean, you go, you see something happens and all you get is, what the? How can, what the, who?
Right.
You know if you try to finish the sentence, your brain was going to have a hemorrhage to keep from killing itself.
Right.
You know, and that's the way it's been for some of those times. You know? Recently, I had to take a leave of absence. You know, and I asked for it. I talked to an assistant store manager and said, I need to take this because if I don't take it, I'm not going to have a job. And he said, why? I said, because I'm going to either say something, I'm going to do something, and it's going to jeopardize my job, and it's going to hurt somebody. I need to take a leave of absence. And it was granted. You know, and I also thank the store manager and the assistant store manager for allowing me to come back and work at that store. You know, they didn't have to. Yeah.
They were understanding.
Yeah.
Because you do a good job when you're there.
I do a very good job. I'm not going to pat myself on the back, but I know I do a good job because I will do anything that needs to be done. And in my record, I actually even changed the tire in the parking lot. I also drove a customer home with her groceries because she wasn't going to make it home because of the way she was feeling. There are a couple of times I've been heading to the bathroom and stopped and helped the customer go right back to the register, knowing I really needed to be in the bathroom at that moment.
Right.
Yep. And I come in early. I mean, I show up early anyways, but if they need me, I'm there already. They don't have to call. They don't have to wonder if I'm going to be there. I have always, my shift has always been covered. Yeah. I have always been here. I have been late once or twice by 2 or 3 minutes. But if I feel like I'm going to be late, I've always called and say, I'm up. On my way. This is what happened. And I'm like, okay. But when I'm there, I'm always prepared to stay later if I need to.
The sense of duty.
It's duty.
Coming out again.
Yeah. The thing is that people coming into that store, if they don't come into that store, I don't have a job. So if they're not being treated well, I don't have a job. And I do. I treat the people that come into the store, I treat them with respect and dignity. I don't care if they're in a wheelchair. I don't care what color they are, what language they speak. These things are not important. They are human beings, and they need to be respected as human beings. I don't care about what they do. No, that is them. You know, they have to deal with that themselves. I have to deal with the fact that they're a human being and they're respected. I respect them as human beings, and I will talk to anybody, and I will listen to anybody. I don't talk to, I talk with.
Right.
And we've had some physically challenged, and we've had some emotionally challenged. Yeah. I remember a movie a few years ago. I saw it a few years ago, and the guy, she's there. Even a poor tailor has the right to be happy. And I thought about that. Everybody comes in that store has the right to be happy. I am not going to take their happiness away from them. They have that right. Who am I to say they cannot be happy? I can't. If I do that to them, they have the right to do that to me. I won't have to agree with it, but they have that right to determine. I have no right to be happy because I've already determined they don't have that right. They might not like me, they might not agree with me, but I'm not going to take their dignity away. They might do that to me, but I'm not going to do that to them.
How do you have any thoughts about the election?
No.
And getting out of this war? Any thoughts about pulling the troops back?
This war is never going to end. There's always going to be a battle someplace under the umbrella of the terrorism. There's always going to be. For the simple fact, how can you eliminate an idea? You can't.
Is that a parallel that you drew from Vietnam?
Yeah. You cannot eliminate a concept, a thought, an idea, a philosophy. You cannot. There are over 7 billion people on this planet. How are we going to say to you, you cannot think that way ever again? Me telling you, you cannot think a certain way is going to drive you to think that way. You cannot do this. You're going to do it because I can't told you you couldn't do it. You know, that is human nature. You know? What are you going to do? We're not living in a Christian world. You know? We're living in a world with Christianity as a part. Yeah. Generally speaking, most of the world hates me because I'm American.
Because we're American.
Yeah. Plain and simple. We were born in this country. We live in this country. We live the philosophy to a degree of this country. They hate us. They don't know us, but they hate us. How are you going to eliminate that? It's like a dog. You keep feeding a dog. Just because you're feeding the dog doesn't mean he's going to like you. I mean, once the food's gone,
yeah,
your leg looks pretty good to him, too.
Bonnie Dale's going to ask you, how would you want to be remembered?
I don't want to be remembered. No, I really don't. I'm one of the thoughts I wrote that you had an opportunity. I'm a voice among many. Let's say I'm a voice. Do I want to be remembered by my kids? Yeah, some of my friends.
As a father.
Yeah. Not as a Vietnam veteran, as a father who loves them, as some of my friends, a friend who cares about them, some of the people I work with, a co-worker, as a Vietnam veteran, no. As someone who did a job, yes. Someone who's tried do his best, okay, and has changed his life. In Vietnam, I was Jewish. Very few people know my religious views right now. Yeah. And I don't tell
you were Jewish.
I was born Jewish.
Okay.
Yeah, and what I do now. We have a couple of people in the store, the same philosophy that I have right now. I go to work to do a job. I don't go to work to preach to anybody. I have never converted anybody's thinking. I will never. I do not want to be known to convert someone's thinking, because you can't. Yeah, you cannot do it. Never. Anyone says, I converted someone, they're either a fool, or the other person did it just to get rid of them.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's your affiliation, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm one of Jehovah's Witnesses.
A Jehovah's Witness.
I got baptized in 1978. Thanksgiving weekend, 1978.
Do you think that the war had anything to do with you, with the conversion?
No.
It was just a personal...
personal decision. I talked to a few person for a couple years before I decided this is something, you know. I wasn't condemned. I wasn't ridiculed. You know, I do go and talk to other people. Yeah. But I do not bring it to work because that's not my place. My place is to... I go to work. I do a job. They ask me to do a job. They don't ask for my political opinion. They don't ask my religious opinion. They don't ask for my opinion other than what I need to be doing. Because I represent the store, United Food, United Market Street. I represent them to the people I'm with. I go in there. They come to me. They associate the company to me, not me to the company, because I talk to them, I help them, I bring groceries out, I put it in a car for them, I answer the questions, I bring them to where it needs to be brought to. I am a representative.
You're still dedicated to the mission.
Yes.
Even though the mission has changed to selling groceries, you're still dedicated.
Since that is my job, anything outside in my private life has to stay out in my private life. Once I leave work and go back to my private life, I gotta leave the problems of work at work, because if I mix the two together, it's gonna be a conflict. Yeah. One of the reasons why I do not date anybody at work, and I do find a couple of them very interesting, and I would love to sit and have a dinner with them and spend some time. But the one of the reasons why I do not date anybody I've ever worked with is simple. If I have a bad moment with them at home, I just brought it to work. I have a bad moment at work because one of us is going to be supervising over the other. I just brought it home.
Right.
Where is that line of home and work? You know, it doesn't exist.
Right.
You know, so I have never, ever dated anybody I've ever worked with.
Somebody that's struggling with being in Vietnam, a brother soldier that may be struggling at home right now, what kind of, could you offer them any kind of advice or help to help them maybe get over
Start writing things down on paper. You put on paper, you cannot deny it. You have an opportunity to go before people who have never experienced it. Do, but limit what you have to say. Only say what you really need to, realizing that they will ask you stupid questions that you cannot answer because they're too stupid. Also understand that there are people out there that really, really want to know what went on. Yeah.
I noticed that on your your writings, you don't sign your name at the bottom.
No.
You leave it anonymous. Is there any particular reason? What's the reasoning behind that?
My thoughts are more important than who did it. You know, if you can look at a poem and say, hey, I understand it. Oh, I know this guy. Really? No. The poem is the most important thing, the thought behind it. Say, oh, I understand it. Yeah. Vietnam Wall, the wall. Never signed it. I did sign it, but I never signed it with my name. It says a Vietnam veteran. Another Vietnam veteran will look at it and say, okay, a brother understood what I was doing. Doesn't need to be my name. I have a copy in D.C. I left it at the Vietnam Wall. Never signed it. They don't need to know who it is. Is it the thought or the person behind the thought that is more important? Is it the emotion and what brings the emotion out? Or who brought the emotion out? Which one's more important? The feeling or name behind the feeling? Everybody's got the same feelings. Everybody. There is no new feelings on this planet. Everybody's got it. Some, like myself, try to eliminate some of the feelings. We don't want to feel it. Don't need to feel it. Why? Who cares? Who understands? You put two Vietnam veterans together, And very few times would you hear them finish a whole sentence. They don't need to. I grew up in an era where you didn't actually have to say thank you to your friends. They knew it. You know, they knew you were saying thank you. I also grew up in an era that I went to a conference one time in Pennsylvania. And I was riding back on the Amtrak to Boston. And a guy got on the train, Amtrak. And there was no one sitting next to me, so he sat down and we were talking. He got off in Connecticut, big black guy, I remember. We were talking. He got off. I got up, hugged each other in the middle of the train. People were looking at us like, a white man hugging a black man? Vietnam veteran. Didn't care what anybody thought. We appreciated each other. We thanked each other. He cut off. I stayed on. Who cares? Yeah. We grew up in an era where it was okay for men to hug each other.
Especially with what you guys went through.
We were a family. We were closer than families. Now Frank is closer to me than my brothers, or my brothers are. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I have a friend back in Boston. I've known him as long as I've known my brothers. He's been my friend as long as my brothers have been alive.
It's important to keep those connections.
Yeah.
And to have them.
But, you know, this generation just, they look at certain things and they've automatically come up with an answer. It's not the right answer. Yeah. And terms that we used in my generation have no, the meanings aren't even close to what they use.
Like what?
That was a bad situation you went through. Bad, my generation. Oh man, that was really horrible, this generation. Hey man, that was cool. Same word, bad. Yeah. Yeah. We grew up in the term queer. Man, that was queer. Meant
weird.
Different.
Weird or something. Yeah.
Doesn't mean that. Here.
I understand.
Yeah. And I talked to one and said, man, he's gay. I said, didn't look happy to me. So what are you talking about? I said, you know, there was a whole decade called the gay 20s.
Right.
Are we like dedicated to the homosexuals, a whole decade for the homosexuals?
Right.
Or were they just plain happy?
Well, Dale, I know that you mentioned that, you know, you guys weren't accustomed to saying thank you to each other, but I want to tell you thank you for your service.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your time today. I really appreciate you doing this and talking about it. I know some of these things you haven't thought about in years.
Yeah.
But I think it's important because people will be able to listen to this interview and learn a little bit more, or learn a lot more.
Yeah. Well, see, I'm a student of human history, human nature. I love human nature. There are certain things that the phrases in history I like. You know.
Can you leave me with one big one that really stands out?
Gentleman walked over to Abraham Lincoln and said, "Abraham Lincoln, you got 8 hours to cut down the tree." Lincoln thought. He says, "You know, if I have 8 hours to cut down the tree, I'll spend 7 hours sharpening my axe. If I'm going to do it, I am going to spend enough time preparing to do that, what I need to do. If I don't prepare, my job is not going to be good. I'm not going to be able to accomplish it."